Climate change sure is one of the most important topics that are on all of our agendas at the moment. So I wish you a warm welcome as well. My name is Daniela Göller and I'm your host tonight. I will lead you through the evening and together with my colleagues, Marike and Gudula. So we're talking about climate change, and more precisely, we're going to talk about COP26. And that was the 21 United Nations Climate Change Conference that just resumed about a week ago in Glasgow. There were very high expectations in the entire world for this conference, and the outcome document was considered anything between pathetic and miserable to successful and better than expected when looking at the international press. So what we want to do tonight is we want to reflect these results of the climate conference and look into what does it mean for us? Like, how do we evaluate these results? What are the consequences for a global and South African climate movement? And what does it mean for global learning? What does it mean for our teaching, our interventions, and further actions to take for all of us? To help us answering these questions or discuss these questions, maybe not answering, we'll see. We are welcoming two speakers here tonight who will give us their perspective on the status of climate change. Welcome to Awande Buthelezi from Climate Justice Charter Movement in South Africa, and to Alejandro Ceballos from the Bildung trifft Entwicklung program. Good evening to both of you and thanks for joining. Both Alejandro and Awande will give us a short introductory statement, which will be about 15 to 20 minutes each. And there will be then an opportunity to exchange ideas in small groups for about 10 minutes. We'll send you into breakout rooms for that. And then afterwards, we'll all come back together again here in the main room to be able to answer questions and discuss what has come up together with the two speakers. We think that we are going to close this session with approximately at 9 o'clock after two short closing statements by our two speakers. So we have roughly 2 hours in front of us that we can spend together. In any case, if there's any questions, any problems, anything, please use the chat. We will watch the chat and you can post also questions already when they come up during the speakers' interventions. But we will only really take the time to discuss them after the breakout groups and after we come back together. So it is my pleasure to introduce you to our two speakers, and it is a special pleasure for me. You've heard it, I've lived in South Africa, so I'm very happy to welcome Awande Buthelezi from South Africa. He is an organizer and researcher at the Cooperative and Policy Alternative Center, COPAC, and an activist with the South African Food Sovereignty Campaign and at the Climate Justice Charter Movement. I've asked both Alejandro and Awande before what is their take on the outcomes of the COP26. And Awande says, I believe that the results of COP26 are both miserable and of great concern to anyone interested in climate justice or an equitable path to tackling the climate crisis for both countries of the global North and South. I believe what we are seeing is a realignment of both countries of the global North, and corporations in both seek to find a way to benefit from this crisis to the detriment of frontline nations and nations of the global South more broadly. Awande, we're looking forward to your statement now. The stage is yours.
Thank you very much. I am going to try not to be a delinquent and be on time, so I'll be recording myself. And I will be just using this presentation as an aid to guide me. So COP26, what are its consequences for the global climate justice movement and in South Africa? So I'm going to begin with just a rehash of the 2018 IPCC report as just a grounding, then going to some of the implications for a warming world in South Africa and Africa specifically, and then use that as a foundation for my reflection and critique of COP26, the Glasgow Pact, its impacts for South Africa and the Global South, and then just some brief statements with regards to what we feel from our activist networks and our people's alternative to COP that we held 2 weekends ago. So the 2018 IPCC report is, I would say, probably a foundational report in terms of the 21st century understanding of the climate crisis. And this IPCC report, its main findings, I believe, are what guides and kind of, you know, solidifies the narrative around the severity of the climate crisis. And I know that this year's one also has built on this narrative. And I think the main suggestion of stopping warming at 1.5 degrees instead of 2 degrees due to the increasing damage to ecosystems, human health, and well-being on a planetary scale were very clear with regards to, you know, the degree to which we need to take this seriously and the degree to which nations of the world, particularly developed states, also need to play their role in averting such a crisis. Its suggestion that a 2 degrees temperature increase could lead to extreme weather patterns, rising sea levels, decreased Arctic sea ice, coral bleaching, and a loss of ecosystems, I think underlines how what was previously being seen as a possible off-ramp for us at stopping at a 2 degrees would be basically condemning entire parts of the world to an existence that is inhumane and other parts of the world becoming unlivable. And I think the main important thing that I wanted to underline is that this report, which came out in 2018, said that we had around 10 years left to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. So time is running out. That was 3 years ago. 3 years ago when it called for a rapid, far-reaching, unprecedented change in all aspects of society. It doesn't mince its words. So what does this mean for my region of the world and the African continent specifically? South Africa and the Southern African region is considered a climate hotspot. Our region of the world is more vulnerable to certain aspects of climate change compared to other parts of the world. So usually when we explain this to people with regards to what hotspot means, just to say that, you know, comparatively stronger climate change compared to other parts of the world. So Southern Africa, for example, will warm at twice the rate of the global average. And we also lack coping capacities due to our economic and socioeconomic conditions. So Southern Africa is made up of developing countries, which everyone is aware of. And we do not have the sophisticated disaster management systems, infrastructure, money to spend on climate adaptation. And our economies are very sensitive to climate shocks, particularly our agricultural and tourism industries. So South Africa, for example, our biggest economic contributor is tourism. Historically, it's been mineral resources, mining, but it's now become tourism. And we've suffered due to COVID. And obviously with climate shocks, we are standing to suffer a lot more. Southern Africa is also a dry and warmer region than most, and it's projected to become drastically warmer and drier. 2021, recently we've come out of what has been on record the longest drought that our country has experienced from 2014 to 2020, end of 2020. And the message of climate change in the heating world is starting to become something which is more and more clearly understood in the South African context. Large parts of our country are without water. That is due to corruption and maladministration, but a large part is also due to the changing nature of climate. And when this drought hits in 2014, some of the parts of the country which were without water are still to this day without water. at that time, I lived in Cape Town during this period. And when we were facing the day zero scenario, which made global news, I also had my own personal experience of what it means when things change to that degree. So with a 3 degree global warming or 3 degree increase, we also will see increases in multi-year droughts, heat waves, and other things which would contribute to the complete collapse of our maize crop and cattle industry. During the period of the drought, which we've just come out of, if South Africa had entered COVID at the height of that drought, we would find ourselves in a very precarious position because we would be very reliant on, you know, importing food to meet our demand. We're already currently struggling through a hunger crisis due to socioeconomic conditions. So add the climate impact of it and the worsening effects of what COVID had introduced into our economy and society, we have currently around 11 million people out of 60 million population who are food stressed, meaning that they don't have a secure source of food or don't know where their next meal is going to come from. So it's a perfect storm of effects when you put all of those things together. And although Southern Africa, our region, is likely to become generally drier under future climates, we can also still expect extreme rainfall events. My family comes from the eastern part of this country, close to Mozambique. And I think that's another example of how this has become more ingrained in the lived experience of people in this region, is the cyclones that come from the east coast, from the Mozambican coast, coming over into the eastern part of South Africa. We don't experience the worst of it, but Cyclone Idai, for example, was a very big event with regards to flooding in certain parts of Mozambique and Zimbabwe, and the eastern parts of South Africa, obviously not as to the degree as Mozambique and Zimbabwe had experienced. So it's also another challenge which is being added to how we need to deal with this crisis. And it's also plausible that the extreme rainfall events will occur more frequently across the region. So we're facing a very paradoxical kind of experience of extreme dryness and extreme rainfall, which happens in an event that is hard for us to be able to capture that water as we would before. So those are the realities of our region of the world. And with that, that is the stakes at which we were entering and understanding where COP and the negotiations at COP were going to impact us from. So out of this COP26 came the Glasgow Pact, as it's now being called. The statements, some countries are describing it as a global compromise that reflects a dedicated balance between interests and aspirations of 200 parties. The pact is not a step change or a species level civilizational transformation, which ties me back to what the 2018 IPCC report was calling for. So if it's not that, then it obviously falls short immediately. And it just promises to shift the responsibility of what it had to take care of into the next COP. And in the press release by the UNFCCC, it states that there are a wide-ranging set of decisions, resolutions, and statements that constitute the outcome of COP26 as the fruits of intense negotiations over the past 2 weeks, strenuous formal, informal work over many months, and constant engagement, both in person, virtually, for nearly 2 years. It's a lot of, you know, fluffy talk to say this was a lot of work for us to get to this point. So please appreciate what has come out of these negotiations, because it shows that we have, there's sweat to show that we have taken us far. They go on to say that the package adopted is a global compromise, and that the core instruments of the international regime that governs global efforts against climate change. So you can already see where this is going. And the statement continues by stating that finance was extensively discussed throughout the session, that there was a consensus on the need to continue increasing support to developing countries. The call to at least double finance for adaptation was welcomed by the parties, and there's a duty to fulfill the pledge of providing $100 billion annually from developed to developing countries was also reaffirmed. and this process to define the new global goal on finance was launched. This for me is the particularly troubling part, because I'm not seeing anything here that says concretely that we have taken large steps forward from Paris, the Paris Climate Agreement. How is it possible that following Paris, following the 2018 IPCC report, following the 2021 report, that you are repeating sentiments which are almost, not almost, actually more than half a decade old, as time is continuing to shrink and shrink for what we can do to deal with this crisis? And on finance, they go on to say that the urgency of enhancing ambition and action in relation to mitigation, adaptation, and finance in this critical decade to address gaps between current efforts and pathways in pursuit of ultimate objective of the convention and its long-term global goals. Once again, nothing concrete about where's the money going to be coming from? Is the money being collected at the rate that we require to? Who's going to be receiving it? How are we going to transfer the necessary skills with the finance to reach these goals in this critical decade? And they go on to say that they note with concern the current provision of climate finance for adaptation remains insufficient to respond to worsening climate change impacts in developing country parties. So, according to a study by the independent think tank Overseas Development Institute, only three of the world's developed countries are meeting their climate finance obligations, these being Germany, Norway, and Sweden. And another study by Oxfam states that these developed countries, which had pledged to provide 100 billion of annual financing, are unlikely to meet this goal. They are even 5 years behind the target. This does not look good from where I'm standing. So the impact for South Africa and the Global South. Prior to COP, there was a report by Bloomberg that officials from the US, UK, France, and Germany were looking to form an agreement with Eskom, South Africa's our state-owned enterprise and natural monopoly power producer, transmitter, and generator. It's also important to note that South Africa generates almost all of its power from a fleet of 15 coal plants, around 85% of our energy, last time I checked. South Africa is also the 12th largest emitter and number one on the African continent. So even though we are a developing country, we do have some responsibility which is not the same as most developing countries. And a large part of this is due to our colonial history and the nature in which minerals and coal has been very central to the identity of our country from the colonial era all the way to our current era. So in America, they speak of the military industrial complex. We have the mineral energies complex in South Africa. And we're currently building two of the top four largest coal power stations. Right now, in this critical point, we are currently still building these coal power stations. So it's a mess. It really is not a good place for us to be. South Africa, however, was the beneficiary of what has been described as a watershed climate finance deal. So that report from Bloomberg was true. The European Union, Germany, France, the UK, and the US have since partnered to support South Africa's climate action goals. This seems to be one of the bigger success stories that have come out of COP to say, hey, look, we are helping nations of the Global South. So they say that they're going to help finance South Africa's move from a heavy reliance on coal to cleaner renewable energy sources. It's also important for me to state that our Eskom is $500 billion, half a trillion South African rands in debt. So obviously our country welcomes this financing because we don't see how else we would have made the transition, seeing as how we have such a large debt already. And these countries have pledged 131 billion rand, around 7.37 billion euros, to help us make this transition over the next 3 to 5 years through what they say will be grants, concessional loans, investments, risk-sharing instruments, and mobilizing private sector funding. There's still a lot of murkiness with regards to how this deal was decided, the degree to which the loans will form part of this, and what are the conditionalities with regards to how we must make this transition, and will there be any transfer and sharing of technology? It's also important to note that prior to the adoption of this deal and what had happened at Glasgow, there was a watering down of some of the phrases used in this deal and some of the words that have come out of this Glasgow agreement, when the Indian delegation announced a last minute change, which led to the replacement of phasing out of coal with phasing down coal. So this has become the coal COP, and hence why South Africa has become this global South poster child of what the COP has achieved. But it's important for me to state that South Africa is also a member of the G20. We have what I can say are cozy relationships with the other G20 countries than some of our fellow BRICS nations, such as Russia, China, India, and to some degree, Brazil. And this, since this has been framed as the coal COP, it's also been used as a way to demonize India and China. And not to say that India and China don't have a role to play with regards to the transition which has to happen over this decade, but it's being used as a particular geopolitical strategy, because this is the phase that we're in now, right? Climate science is the new geopolitics. And it's being used as a stick to say India and China aren't doing enough. We can therefore be as harsh as we'd like to on them because they're not doing enough. But it's important to state that China's per capita emissions versus the US are much better than the US, you know, who's also a historical emissions far pays the Chinese ones. So they already have that responsibility that they have to fulfill. China has also said that there'll be no more funding for overseas coal plants. I don't want to let them off the hook, but I do think that is a significant announcement coming from them. And I think it's one which should merit a beginning of greater consultations to help them do more. And China's also currently and projected to continue being a leader in renewable manufacturing. And we need some of that South-South cooperation, but we also need the Global South to also help facilitate some of that knowledge transfer to other countries of the Global South. So we had a People's COP, and I just wanted to end on this to say that some of our disappointments and perspectives from activists in South Africa, across the African continent, and others from the Global South who we've communicated with during these processes was that we thought that this COP would be the one that mattered. Well, we didn't think, but we knew that it was supposed to be the one that mattered. So there was that expectation with regards to the seriousness of this COP. But it's everyone has seen everything that was coming out of COP from the moment it began was that this was, as some have said, perhaps the most exclusive COP to date. At our alternative to COP meeting, we had Alex Rafalovitz, the director of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, who was at COP at the time, but speaking to our event, saying that, you know, as someone who has followed COP and climate negotiations for a while now, he was very concerned to see what he saw as the complete deregulation of international rule system on climate change. He said that since the early 2000s with the Kyoto Protocol, which was very flawed, but it had binding, quantified commitments that countries needed to meet to keep them accountable. And when Obama came into presidency, he wanted the US to become seen as a global leader on climate. But if you follow his domestic policy, he also superseded any previous administration with regards to investments in fossil fuels. But regardless of that, we had Paris, and it was lauded as some kind of victory from his administration and the nations of the West. But COP26 was meant to be the one which, you know, reviewed these pledges and took things further. Instead of them being reviewed, there were announcements. And that's those statements I was reading at the start read like announcements because they were just announcements. And under the rules-based system, governments led by the UK as the chair were simply making these announcements on the fringe of the process. There was no form of accountability being introduced. And the overwhelming sense of how people feel is that there's a betrayal of the youth, which has to be said. I have not stated that explicitly, but the people who will live throughout this crisis are being fundamentally thrown to the wolves. And what we need and what we require is a fair and real deal, which is negotiated in the open, detailed transparency regarding how these decisions are made and agreed upon by world leaders. And I'd like to end on that note by just saying that that is what we need. And it is disheartening to see the levels of representation that fossil fuel companies and other major corporations were given at the expense of civil society and global climate activists. And with that, I'd like to end my presentation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Awande. That was a very complete presentation. I take from that number one, the COP26 was not really at the height of the expectations and also not really at the height of the task ahead. We are running behind our own agenda, actually. Thanks for reminding us of the prior agreements and what has already been said there. So it's also, I think that it was a valuable point to say we also need to measure these results at what has been said and done before, and then we can take out all of the repetitions that are just basically restating the things that have been stated before and not taking actual steps on it. And what I also take from your statement is that the text is in large parts possibly because of the watering down that comes with too many people working on a single text, so open in big parts, so open for interpretation, that it becomes dangerous at a point where there was an expectation, and I think not only from the global south, but also from other parts of the world, where there really was an expectation of having more binding words and binding agreements coming out of this. So I guess these are points that we will have the opportunity to talk about later. I want to introduce my colleague here and hand over the word to Alejandro. We are having our second input now. So please welcome Alejandro Ceballos. He was born in Venezuela, so we will hopefully get another angle at the climate change from another country of the global south as well. Alejandro studied environmental science and worked for 10 years at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, teaching environmental policy and climate change. He's passionate about social justice, gender, intercultural communication, racism, extremism, traditional knowledge, Latin American critical thinking, decolonization, I guess decolonization is part of Latin American critical thinking, and food sovereignty. Alejandro, I've asked him the same question than Awande, and he said, the results of COP26 are the best they can be, but the small farmers of Paraguay's Gran Chaco facing severe droughts, the Filipino children and women whose homes are being destroyed by typhoons, the racialized African-American women in Louisiana, the Wayuu people who have been forced off their ancestral lands by the global coal industrial complex, the Turkana people who are embroiled in the conflict due to the impacts of land grabs and climate change, and millions of others were not invited to COP26, and their voices were not heard. Climate justice is about the struggle of people who are now facing the devastating impacts of climate change and their children, who will face even greater challenges. Climate justice is about social injustice, the struggle against racism, colonial power structures, and the exploitation of nature, including humans. Thank you, Alejandro. Please take the word.
Thank you very much for being here. I thanks everybody for your organization, and Awande, thank you for your excellent presentation. I have to start here my clock so I don't pass my limit of time. And actually, I have made some notes here, and what I am not going to talk about today, what happened in COP26. So I apologize for that. I was in Copenhagen at the University of Copenhagen in COP15. That was when after the or during this COP I remember that was the same feeling. And I was in the city when it was happening. So that feeling was even greater. No? this feeling of excitement, of hope. And there was also this People's Cup, no? Also. And at the end, as you remember, there was this Danish, so-called Danish text, and everything was, the hope was gone, and that feeling of deception. And I remember that very well. And me being from the Global South, being a racialized person, experienced the damaging effects, the negative effects of climate change in my country, in my family. I am not going to be talking about the COP16 because I will talk from my experience with the collective in Venezuela, from the grassroots movement. That is my point of enunciation. No, that is where I make my statement. I believe that when we look at the situation of these people, the struggle of these people, is where we can find the solutions, the way, other way of thinking that can give us solutions, other kind of solutions. Also, being from Venezuela, I am not a big fan of technocrats, bureaucrats, or politicians. I know that, of course, there are many people doing many good things, but I will repeat that my point of enunciation is the struggle of the small farmers, of the people suffering not just from climate change, but from all the different systems of oppression that we have today in this global system. I hope to spark some debate, to be provocative and controversial, and so that we can engage in some fruitful conversations. I said also that because we all know what happened in the COP26, and we also know that, from some of the calculations made from some researchers, people from the IPCC and also from different universities, we know that if all countries that signed that paper actually implement all these measures that they said that they will implement, we will still have a rise of temperature of 2.4 grad Celsius by 2100. And that's it, of course, they are devastating from mostly countries in the Global South. I want to first make a very important point, and I made this text because I just want to make this clear. I will read it. Man-made climate change and the destruction of the environment are a social phenomenon. The historical responsibility for the current climate and environmental crisis lies largely in the shoulders of Western civilization. This is also, this is why I also agree with Awande when he talked about this issue with the focus in China and India. We use that in order to kind of forget or not talk about this historical responsibility the North Atlantic or the West culture civilization had. At the core of this crisis is the perception of nature as an object that can be measured and exploited. In this mindset, nature and human cultures are simplified and optimized to produce output in the form of goods and services. This is, for example, the production of monoculture. No, we try to simplify nature in a way where we destroy diversity to, for example, produce food. No, we, and a monoculture, in order to maximize the production of food, you need to destroy the diversity and just for example, have just corn. No? This is this simplification. And that happens with language, with knowledge, and with cosmovisions, etc. The belief that highly complex systems can be simplified, reduced to systems of production of goods and services is a very narrow way of thinking. It is a provincial way of thinking. It is not universal. This way of thinking alone cannot help us to tackle the current crises. For example, the climate change crisis, the environmental crisis, racism, human exploitation, and the rise of conflicts all around the world. We need a broader view of reality. We need to open our eyes to other knowledge, other way of thinking, of feeling. It is common knowledge that other cultures have a completely different approach to nature. There are sources of knowledge that can help us overcome the complexity, the complex challenges we face today. We need the COPs, of course, is a way of looking at things. When we talk about financiations, loans, credits, new energy sources and stuff, yeah, that's a way of looking at things. But just this way of looking at things will not solve all problems that we have. Because as I said in my statement, climate change is not just about CO2 emissions. It's also about colonial structure of power, about racism, exploitation, it's about land grabbing, it's about exploiting water resources, it's about armed conflicts, production of weaponization of nations. This is an extremely complex problematic that cannot just be solved with that way of thinking or just that kind of mentality that we see in the COPs. I will say that for us in the Global South and my contact with the different grassroots movement collective, for us it's very clear that industrial nations will not stop their CO2 emissions. For us, it's very clear that we did not manage to stop climate change, because climate change is already happening and it will get worse. For us, what this is important is to see how we will adapt to climate change, because we don't have to reduce emissions. And while I am, and I remember, I'm not talking about Venezuela, the nation, the colonial national state of Venezuela, nation state. I am talking about the people. This is another point. These COPs and stuff, these are like intergovernments deals. But what we, as a grassroots movement or collective, for us, what is important is see how we adapt to climate change, see how we can empower ourselves in order to survive the next decades and in the future. We are talking about going strong against colonial system of oppression, about, against racism, about industrial agricultural complex system that is destroying our ecosystems. Because climate change is of course, is a problem for many small farmers and indigenous peoples, BIPOC, all around the world. But most of these people also are suffering because they don't have land. Their land has been stolen since colonial times. They have been criminalized. They have been oppressed. They have been displaced from their ancestral land. These are all elements of this crisis. And this is one point that I want to make clear, that for us, this is what climate justice means. Climate justice is just not climate justice, it's just social justice. Something that look into the whole picture, the whole oppressions. Climate change is also an oppression. It's the monopolization of Western civilization of the atmosphere. This just grab our atmosphere and pollute it. It's just also that kind of colonialism. Yeah? It's the same, yeah? Just taking space for them. And we need to be also clear that there is a differentiated responsibility, because what I'm saying here, I know Venezuela is also producing. We are one of the biggest oil importers. But again, this is the national state, the colonial state. And this is why my enunciation, and this is, I want to make this very clear, come from the people that are suffering the most. We also need to talk about, educate ourselves. You know? We need to adapt. We need to work with food security. We do a lot of work, for example, the people in Venezuela with the development of ecological food systems, the fostering of biodiversity, something that is a part of our adaptation plan, not the COP adaptation plan, of course. But also we need to expose this colonial way of thinking or this kind of fantasy that is that the West, Europe and America or China will help us to develop. This is also colonial racist thinking. We need to get out of that way of thinking where we see that this is the way we have to go. You know? Getting new energy and stuff. Europe, for example, here, Germany is one of the biggest polluters per capita in the world. But in the German media, on you ask people around, I live in Germany, most people in the media also, it seems as the world champion in climate protection. But this is something that is really hypocritical. No, it's also like Denmark. Denmark is also, I was at the University of Copenhagen 10 years and my colleagues also laugh about this fantasy, this kind of psychosis that some countries and some cultures have, that they are the best of the best. Denmark actually has higher CO2 emissions per capita than Germany or England or other European countries. I want to make clear that this is something that we have to take into account, that for us, colonial structure of power and the different oppressions many people face today cannot be taken out of the picture. This is why I make this statement about the COP26, and I hope we can include some of these thoughts in the further discussions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alejandro. We're still good in time, so we even slightly ahead of the schedule, so everybody can relax. What I take from your very, very passionate and also very heartfelt statement is, by far the fact that it moved me, the problem is actually much bigger than just CO2 or just talking about climate change. It's not a, like an isolated problem that we can somehow handle and then shelve and then it will be good. There's so much more that actually is attached to it. So we also have to look at the fact that what is the biggest accusation probably held to date at our economic system is that it is based on the exploitation of both social and environmental, the social and the environmental realm. One of the reasons why we have these sustainability goals, where we constantly actually try to counter this imbalance that is created by like one taking over the other. And that obviously also applies to an historically built political imbalance, in when we look at the world between the so-called global north and the so-called global south due to colonization and globalization, that we are somehow called to mediate in different ways, but maybe also mediate between these political decision-making levels and the real concerns of people on the ground. Yeah, how do we deal with that as educators who go out and try to bring these ends together? And what I also liked is the idea that you brought up, that we actually all need to learn, and it is very clear after what both of you have said that this is not a thing that someone can solve, or we're not at a state where we can actually distribute responsibilities, and we need to solve this together. It really needs a common effort. So I guess that is probably the biggest challenge. How do we manage to come together? But our little reunion here today around this topic is one step in the right direction. So we need more of these coming togethers and more possibilities, I guess, to talk and to exchange, but knowing that we somehow have an emergency, because these effects of the climate change are not waiting for us to finally agree with one another, but we also need to take action. So with these thoughts and kind of inputs, resumes of our inputs, I would like to conclude this part and ask Marieke to send us all into breakout rooms to give you some opportunity and some space to also reflect in a smaller group. The good thing about the breakout rooms is that actually now you all have your cameras on and I can finally see your faces. So thanks for that. We can all see each other now. Great. And since we are a small group, I think we can also just leave the cameras on for those who think it's okay. Anyway, we're not recording the image, we're recording the sound. So, but I think it's nice for us to be able to see each other. So I hope you had a good time and fruitful discussions. And we can continue together. I'm quite curious to see what you have come up, what your reactions are, especially, of course, with regard to the question, what does it actually all mean for us as teachers, as educators, as mediators, as multipliers, as activists, as people who go out there, who talk to different people, to the youth, to the elder people, to maybe the politicians as well. So what is our role? What is there that we can do, or what should we do? But you are, of course, also free to share any other thoughts that have come up for you. So please feel free. What were your thoughts? What was most important? What came up in your discussions? Is there something that you want to share? You can just unmute yourself and feel free to talk or give me a sign, whichever way you like.
So I was just looking for the hand function, but I can't seem to find it. I just wanted to say, from our group, we just understanding the different backgrounds where people come from and what has led them to this topic and how we all enter into this topic. And also to emphasize Alejandro's point is that there's the different intersections and the different ways in which you can connect to understanding climate justice and climate more broadly, or the climate crisis, really important to emphasize because everyone's got a different perspective, different base of knowledge which they'll be coming from, which inputs and adds to how we understand the multiplicities of this crisis.
Which actually doesn't necessarily make it easier, but talks to the fact that we have to come together, because it's not something that any of us can solve on their own. So this is an important process to actually see how can we bring people together. Maybe that is also one of the major tasks that we have as people who are aware, as people who are active. Yeah, how can we bring people together, unite people? Alejandro.
Exactly, and I just want to continue with those lines about bringing people together. I work giving some lectures and workshops here in Germany since 2 years ago or something, 3 years ago. For the past 2-3 years, I have been doing that, and for the last 7 years or something, I have been working with the collective in Venezuela. And what I feel, what I see a lot in Germany is when we are talking about these issues, there is a lot of sadness and frustration in the people. No? Your people. I'm going to say Germans, because when I give a talk, they're mostly Germans. You see that the people are very frustrated and they are powerless. They don't know what to do, and they have pain, because many people know what are their responsibility in the crisis. They know how much they consume, how much we consume and produce CO2 produce and stuff, and how destructive is our way of life. We know that, and that is painful. We are in a system of oppression, and we are the privilege, but we don't escape of the pain. This is more or less what there is this analogy with the master and slave relationship. I think that Franz Fanon speak about that. And he said that the master and the slave are both a slave, because both are in this violent relationship. So a master will never be able to be integral, holistic human being, because he's immersed in this destructive relationship. And we are in Germany here, very privileged, where we know we are in this destructive relationship. And what I have learned from the people in Venezuela is that the people, this collective, they suffer police violence, land grabbing, pollution, climate change, droughts, flood, murder of families, crime. But these people are so full of hope and energy and power. They are so powerful. They will go and they have to work, of course, 10, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, sometimes doing jobs that are not very cool. And after that, they have this time to do making these meetings and doing political work. And And it's so amazing, the power, so powerful. And I don't understand how carries that so privileged people in Germany feel so powerless and so sad. Yeah? And I, from my point of view, is that when I see our life in industrial, civilized countries or cultures, individualism is a big thing. We are individual, we are alone, we are isolated. This is kind of way of thinking, no? We isolate us for nature and stuff. And in other cultures, I think that we are, or other cultures, when I'm talking about other cultures, for example, the Hopi culture in the Amazonia, they say that we are relationships. We are intellectual relationship, or cognitive relationship, spiritual relationships. And we are always connected with nature, giving and receiving, or getting penetrated by nature all the time. And that gives, of course, a totally different perspective. And I relate that with this theory of the big government and the small citizen. When we are alone, we are individual, we are fragmented, and we don't have power. And I feel that this is one of the main reasons political crisis that we have today.
So you think that if we don't unite is actually going to tear us even further apart.
Exactly. And that what you just said, the way to go is become relationships with people, get together with people, and this is happening in this grassroots movements when they go to for urban gardening project and they start cooking together and doing stuff together, and they get that power from there. And we need power. We need to empower ourselves and start talking to people and start getting united. Start weaving this social connection network again.
Instead of remaining in the pain or in the place of powerlessness. Yeah. How do we empower each other? That is also a good question. And also something that I think that we can in our role, we can contribute to that. How do we actually empower the people instead of, without making beautiful pictures of things that are terrible, but giving people information, important information, but without depressing them or without putting them in a place of pain where they cannot act anymore, but in a place of empowerment where they can actually feel empowered and feel connected to the world, but also to other people in other parts of the world. I think that is also important. So things like evenings like today, where we have a one day, or we can actually exchange with people who are coming from different places, and we can feel that bond that we're all together here because this is one question that all brings us together. That is powerful, I guess. Yeah. Thanks for that. How are other people reacting to that? What was your feelings? How do you relate to these questions? Is there more to share from the breakout rooms?
Marike had a question in the chat. So, Marike.
Thank you. My question when I was thinking about this evening was concerning our educational work, would be the question, what can people learn from climate activists in the global south? Or is there a connection between climate activists here and there? Is it comparable what they are experiencing? And I would like to ask Awande, because you're coming out of this great climate justice charter movement, and you've been working on a really broad networks to build it up. And yeah, maybe you could tell a little bit about the processes that led into this climate justice charter, and what role played education in this, and probably that maybe there was also some kind of international exchange in this. So if you maybe could tell us a little bit about this, I would be thankful.
So, I'll mix those into one, the experience of climate justice activists in the Global South, and also my experience in the charter movement, because for me, they really are kind of intertwined. Like, my coming into the charter movement, as I was saying in the breakout room, is also intertwined with my climate justice activism work began, because initially I was a student, was doing my master's, and I wasn't really focused on climate. I understood climate. I read about IPCC reports and I knew how serious it was. But, and this is also underlines also the perspective that we're coming from, and the kind of educational work that we have to do in the Global South, which may be different from what has to happen in the Global North. As much as I understood climate and its seriousness, I, like many other people, activists, progressive thinkers, and young people in my country, in this region of the world, saw it, but we saw it as something which will be taken care of by other people. We have more pressing matters to deal with: inequality, the economy. We have gender-based violence as a problem in this country. There's so many other things that we're so focused on and are on top of our list of priorities with regards to what we're dealing with right now, that climate, and particularly because of how climate has been phrased historically, just seemed like something which you should have a privilege to even think about. Like, it's not even something that we should be concerned with. And during my studies, as I was trying to think around alternatives, particularly within our context, but alternatives with regards to the political economy of my region of the world and how we interact with nations of the Global North, looking for alternative developmental paths, I was led into the work of climate. Funnily enough, by there was a German lecturer who came to give a talk the week when I was really deciding what I'll be focusing on. And I was thinking towards more automation and things of that nature, because that's where people's minds are at. And the talk that she gave kind of highlighted how, well, due to the nature of climate change and what we need to do to deal with it, and the mineral resources required for that, and for Alejandro actually spoke about this with regards to the arms race happening right now of the China, Russia, America, with regards to next generation military technology, electric car manufacturing, and the required minerals for renewable technologies. We don't have enough for all of those things. We can do some of them, we can maybe do half of them, but we can't do all of them. And currently that's what's happening. So at a physical level, if you're thinking about your economy, you think about economic development, and you think about these new industries of manufacturing, and then the climate crisis and the severity, that's the physical kind of barrier that we're at. And for me, that was a fundamental moment in my own education to think, well, okay, this climate thing is central. And in joining the Climate Justice Charter movement, which at the time didn't exist, but was just a loose affiliation of different groups, trade unions, water activists, rural women's groups, small-scale farmers, different groups dealing with environmental concerns in their own way, that came together and added different parts of what they were facing, which led to the Climate Justice Charter movement. It was in the praxis that my activism began and my own education began. And the kind of responsibility that I feel as a climate activist in the Global South is one of educating fellow citizens of the Global South, particularly in Africa, South Africa, the severity of what climate change means and how central it is to all the other questions that we have to fundamentally grapple with to improve our societies. So that's the kind of educational responsibility that I have, is to impart that knowledge on everyone I interact with, debate, speak with on any of the topics that really concern us, that, you know, you can't separate climate from any of these. And what the Climate Justice Charter tries to do, and what we try to do as climate justice activists in the charter movement, is to show, because what happens with climate, and I hope maybe you can also correct me also from your perspective, but what happens is that the climate justice activism is a reactive, or it seems to be a reactive process. We speak about what's happening, what's not happening, and you know, the fact that we it's like you're the bad news bear. You're always saying that things are bad, things are going to get worse, things need to get done, but you never talk about what needs to be done in practical terms. So that's what we're trying to do in our activism, is to say things are bad, but here are the alternatives. Here's what we can do to make our society better. All the things that you're grappling with, here, look, this is how it's included in a climate justice framework. And this is how taking on the struggle of climate justice can help in pushing gender equality, can help in minimizing economic inequality in a society, can help with all these other things. So that's what we've done in our activism, and that's what we're trying to push forward.
There was a comment in the chat from Julien. I believe that it is also important to look at what alternatives already exist, which are also already being lived, and how we can build on this. So puts it together what you already said, Avande.
It fits nicely in the. Yeah, I guess it's also the question is also a lot about communicating. So I like that about what you said. Is it like how do we talk about what do we talk? Are we actually sticking with the reaction part, or are we becoming active on our own, making proposals? Yeah, being proactive maybe, but not being in this we only reacting and we only the ones who point out what is wrong, what doesn't go. Let's be positive in and constructive in the sense that let's show other ways to go. And I wanted to add another question on that, because there was something that really troubled me when I was reading through the newspapers after the COP26, and that was a statement by an Italian journalist in La Repubblica, who was also tackling the communication problem, but from another side. He was actually pointing out that we are about to lose the young generation because they no longer feel that they have a say, or that they are heard, or that it is even worth talking to us or talking to the elder generation. And that was somehow alarming me number one, because that means we have a serious communication issue here, that if the young people stop talking, stop engaging in the discussion, then that becomes a massive problem for everyone. And also, it's something that I feel very concerned about as being actually someone who goes out to teach young people, isn't like, how can I maintain this conversation? So maybe Alejandro or Awande or anyone else for that matter wants to add to that. You can, of course, also please feel free to speak German, or to also write your questions in German if you are not comfortable with English. That's also totally fine. We'll manage with translations and everything.
I'll break the ice with regards to that question, particularly because it's a very important question for us where we are right now. It's particularly in my country. Like, the African continent is a young continent. The majority or the average African is young. I don't know what the numbers is, but it's something around below the age of 30. And in my country specifically, that it's growing, but like the average is also in people in their mid to late 20s. So I also form part of that demographic of youth. But we suffer particularly from that perspective of not being heard. As I was saying, we have a whole host of other problems that we look at. And one of those is youth representation and the degree to which youth are included in decision-making processes and our ability to actually enter into the spaces where we can be effective in making change. So I know that in global North countries such as Germany and European countries, there's a demographic difference where there's an older majority as opposed to a younger minority, and that younger minority is being crowded out. So the numbers also does not help in terms of how they feel represented. Whereas for us, we have the opposite, where we are the majority as the youth, but the older people have crowded in and kept power to themselves and have closed the doors to institutions which would allow for younger people to make that change. So it's a question that is very, very central to our thinking as young people, particularly in the Global South. And I wanted to point something that Alejandro was saying about questions of despair versus hope, in that, you know, there is a degree of despair that we feel, but it's one which kind of fuels a fire of, you know, wanting action. I could almost say that the youth, particularly from where I am in this region of the world, it's almost like a ticking time bomb. In that we're not only going to be disengaged, but we're going to be reactive and we're going to be angry. And when we're angry, we're going to take action. And in my own personal experience from my university days, an example of this is when I was at the University of Cape Town, we had the Rose Must Fall movement, where it was trying to push the removal of some of these colonial legacies, the Statue of Rhodes particularly, but it opened up a question about the nature of coloniality in our country. And it's something which has not gone away and is there to stay. And following that, we had the Fees Must Fall movement, which was questioning the, you know, inequality and the way in which young people are not being given an avenue for which they can better themselves due to the wall that Fees were offering. And even though that did not succeed, it's become a feature in the thinking of young people in this country. That is a struggle which still has to be met. So I would say that, you know, as a response is to not, as an educator, do not look at it in a way in terms of young people may be disengaged and you've lost them in that way, but also the potential in which that alienation can light a fire within them for young people to really want to get their hands on, you know, any kind of platform to make the change that they're not seeing right now.
Thank you very much, Awanda, for those words, powerful words, and the fire. Yeah, that's nice. I like that. I would like to bring about some examples from Venezuela. We are also a young, very young land and country. And of course, people are desperate too in Venezuela, of course, especially when you look at poverty, crime, environmental pollution, and all these social struggles, problems that we have in our country, 10% inflation. Etc. The movements that I have been working with in Venezuela, they have when they for example, they do their the educational work in their communities, in poor communities, and in the cities, or this chanty towns areas around the city that are very common in Venezuela. They use very different methods in order to engage the youth. But first of all, there is a lot of problems or there is not a lot of options for young people in Venezuela to do anything, actually. No, I mean, poverty, and unemployment and stuff like that. Now, of course, these young people will be the the victims of street violence and drug addiction and many other problems, of course. And one of the collectives, the Patucuruco collective in Venezuela, they work a lot with these urban gardenings, and there is a bunch of methods they use in order to transmit this knowledge. Now, we are talking about the fostering of diversity in our food systems. Don't forget that I think that 30% of the greenhouse gases emissions come from our food. Here in Germany, we literally eat oil, yeah, because all the food we consume here is based on fertilizer, industrial fertilizers, and they are mostly produced with huge amount of heat that come from fossil fuels, of course, and the machines and everything, yeah, and the transportation. I mean, the agriculture is big. The agriculture industrial complex is extremely destructive. And we try to bring about this knowledge of using already solutions that are already there. The way the people, for example, the indigenous people used to eat, the diversification of our diet, try to develop climate-proof diets, and all this knowledge that they produce there in their gardens, they give it to, or they transmit it to the youth in form of hip hop, or in form of painting, or graffiti art, or poetry, or games, or this is the music. This is something that engage this youth, but it's also this way of diversifying this the way that we transmit knowledge. Now, going away from this, okay, knowledge, you transmit knowledge in this institutionalized way of the university, of the school, with this paper, reading books or stuff, and you have to sit there, down there, and I don't know how many hours in a chair, and put the thing in your brain two weeks, and after that you don't know anything. And this is something that for me is a way of what education should look like for that new way of looking at things, or new ways of doing things, or new solutions that are already there. They have been, of course, to call imperialism and colonialism and racism. They have been is to destroy, oppress, but there is a huge amount of knowledge that is there, and we are trying to get it back, to put some more fire on that so that it grows.
Yeah, true. I think that is an important point as well. Knowledge and most of them, also access to knowledge and production of knowledge. I very much liked what Walter Mignolo once said, that he doesn't like this notion of production of knowledge, and he was suggesting to replace knowledge production by knowing and world making. And I like that very much, because it also implies, but part of what you said, I think we have a lot of knowledge, but it's also we don't access a lot of it. So the question is also how can we access these knowledges that are there, because again, there's people who are not invited to the table, there is knowledge systems that are not acknowledged in the same way than others are, so we are also like cutting ourselves off certain kinds of knowledge, even though we have them in our societies, even here. I mean, you all live here, not Awande, but Alejandro, you know, so we have people from all over the world who live all over the world. So we could have more exchange of knowledge, and we don't really take advantage of it. I guess that's also an important point when talking about teaching, using what knowledge, whose knowledge, and how do we access it, how do we give people access to it, and who's speaking, why, all these questions.
Just going to say something very quickly from a thinker from Chile. He said, we know a hell of a lot. We know a lot, but we understand very little. But going to leave it there. Thank
you. Yeah, lots of thoughts here in the room. I can look into faces, serious faces engaged in heavy thinking. Is there anyone who wants to share a bit of what is going through their minds? Yes, please, Tino.
Well, when we discussed in the room, we found the problem that often the discussion is between nations. And my question is, how can we reach that solidarity isn't bordered by nations, and how can we be connected and be solidary to find solidarity over these borders? I think when we look at the Ukraine, for example, or we can see Europe has high worth. I don't know. Ich muss kurz mal auf Deutsch wechseln, sonst bin ich zu unklar im Sprechen. Europa trägt immer sehr viel die Menschenrechte rhetorisch vor sich her. Und wenn man dann sieht, was die dann in der Realität wert sind oder wenn es in einen konkreten Fall geht, muss man feststellen, da gibt es eine gewisse Diskrepanz zwischen Rhetorik und Handeln. Und meine Frage ist, wie schafft man es, diese Strukturen, dieses Denken in Nationen, diese Begrenzung aufzubrechen und wirklich Solidarität global betrachten zu können? Ich finde, das ist eines der Hauptprobleme. Also klar, dass es keine Regierungsfähigkeit global gibt, das sieht man an solchen Konferenzen, aber auch, dass Solidarität häufig an den Ländergrenzen endet. So, wie kann es da Lösungen geben?
Thank you. I'm quickly going to jump in for Awande. I think we lost you halfway. The most important thing, though, has been said before we changed into German. That was this question of the nation state and how does actually the nation state bother in the conversation or hinder real talk between people. And on the other aspect that Tino was adding was this question of like how also countries act, talk and act differently. So this is the famous thing of walk the talk. So the example that he was given with Ukraine, you might have heard the word Ukraine in the middle, was that he said the EU is always coming here with human rights and lots of very high standards, and on the other hand, when you look at the actions, they don't correspond. So there is a discrepancy between what is held up high and on one hand on a moral stance, and then what is actually done on the ground. So there is this contradiction also sometimes, and the question really here is on how do we overcome these also national boundaries, I guess, in given the fact also that this global government that we have with the United Nations also somehow seems to be very complicated and not very effective. So how can we get out of this situation in a constructive way? I hope I resumed it nicely, Timo.
Can I respond to that?
Please.
I think that's such a great question. And I think for a country like Germany, there's a greater sense of responsibility when you think of that kind of question. given the position where Germany is within the EU, but also Germany's stature globally, the kind of power and prestige that it carries with it. And for where I am, South Africa may not be a Germany, but I feel the same implications of the same kind of hypocrisy that can play out at the level of a nation state. Our country likes to lord our constitution as this forward-thinking thing that came out of struggle. So we put human rights above everything, and our perspective as a country with regards to human rights is so advanced because of our history, Nelson Mandela, all those things. But over the past 27 years, we've seen that eroded. We've seen it eroded in how the state treats its own people. We've seen it eroded in how the state carries out its foreign policy. And I think that it's emphasized a lot for us here that, you know, some of the things that matter most in actually carrying out international solidarity definitely go beyond the nation states and these multilateral platforms that they've created for themselves, which have become self-congratulatory. You pat each other on the back just because we're there. And I take this space, as I was saying in our breakout room, is this for me is an act of international solidarity. This is an act of, this is an expression of my climate justice activism, to have these conversations with people on the other side of the world, give my perspective, hear their perspective. And I think that for people in the global north, and I'll actually also for us in the global south, as I was listening to what Alejandro was saying about the movements and collectives that he was working with back in Venezuela, I think it's incumbent on us to do the work of finding out what's being done on the other side of the world in relation to the work that we're doing. What's being done on the other side of the world, educate yourself on what they're doing, their struggles, their success, like what they, where they succeed and where they fail. And in that, you can even take the next step of reaching out to try see where you can, you know, plug into those processes. How can you help? How can you expand and amplify that work that's already being done? And that for me is what tonight is. And I think that the problem we have globally is that we have this international order, which has been built over the 20th century on a foundation of certain structures and platforms, which have with them a kind of, it's an unsaid thing that they're supposed to be fair. For example, the UNFCCC and COP, those processes are supposed to be the spaces where things get done. But as we can see, nothing is happening. In fact, you could even argue that these processes are actually stalling real work from actually being done. So my response to what Timo was saying is that I think what we need are these kind of spaces, finding ways to amplify, expand, and diversify these spaces so that they can be truly reflective of the different perspectives and different kinds of activism that is happening on the ground. I think that we are at the kind of beginning of understanding that. And I think that I could see some of that from what people were saying at COP. But for me, I think that we need to move completely beyond COP. We need to move completely beyond those platforms. We need to delegitimize those platforms and then build our own alternatives beyond the nation states.
That is a word for civil society and civil engagement. Marike, I see you were posting an M into the chat. Is that a question or a comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to add because I can see also this kind of process within the German climate activists for the last 10 years, say so. They were building up climate camps, and it was a place to network and to educate yourself, to learn from each other, but also becoming active and learning, for example, what is civil disobedience. And in the last years, there was a development. They were starting to think more intersectional, to be more inclusive and self-reflecting about their activism, and also starting to hear perspectives perspective from the Global South and inviting them to come and learn from our actions and going there and being active. And this is going on. And now I have the question, okay, maybe we should go out of schools. We should go and build up huge climate camps where we learn from each other become active. And also, what was one aspect in the climate camps, which I find really important, is in the life itself in the camp, we tried to live this utopia, how it should be, how should we share, and how should people be included, so to say. So this makes like a positive thinking to me, that there was this process in the German activist scene, and that they started to connect with others. And Fridays for Future, for example, is the same. There's a lot of exchange going on, and still people in different countries are doing different things because the surrounding is differently. But as they are connected, there's this solidarity coming up, and this makes us stronger, I guess.
Again, togetherness, and maybe finding different platforms also for it, finding different ways of connecting and interacting. And I like what you were saying about let's connect. It's fine when they do UN global climate whatever, but we can do our own global climate action, and we can be as strong, or maybe even be stronger, maybe at the end of the day outsmart them, because we are more, or we are closer to what is actually really happening, and we're not concerned about these nation categories and who can do what, and we're not part of this game, which is also an advantage that we have, I guess, because we're not in these representative roles, not in the same way than the politicians are. We're not caught in these systems. So I guess that also gives us an opportunity to fill another space, so to strengthen that whole process even further. I see David clapping hands. Do you want to add something, or do you prefer to?
No, I was just thinking about the last sentences you said. In my head, I had the connection that this community activism also makes sense on a level of resources. So natural resources or material resources, because as we have talked about before, all the solutions that are being pushed at the level of the COP, for instance, require a lot of resources. So this whole new renewable energy thing is fine, and this is, we need it probably, yes, but still it requires a lot of resources. And if we're thinking in structures like the climate camp or stuff like that, so building things from the ground up, we don't have a lot of resources. So naturally, we will look for solutions that don't require a lot of resources. So yeah, there's also maybe something good already built in it.
The togetherness. I was just looking at the time now, and I can see it's almost 9:00. So we have filled the 2 hours with a lot of interesting talks, thoughts, questions, ideas. I take quite a lot of inspiration from it, and I wish we could actually meet again and rediscuss that, but I hope we will in maybe different setups. Not all of us, but some of us, and we will all carry this on. Are there any final statements, short statements, maybe from Alejandro and Awande? Can you give a as a little flashlight of what is it that you are taking away from tonight? What is your last thought?
All right, I'm going to start with that. I just want to thank you for tonight. It was very inspiring. And just remember that we need to get together, be strong, and that we are relationships. We are not alone. That make us strong. Thank you very much for all of you. That was a really nice experience. A wonder. Thank you very much. And all the organization, all the participants.
I just want to echo what Alejandro said, and I just want to thank everyone. I want to thank Alejandro also for the input that he gave. It's nice to hear a different perspective from the Global South, of a Latin American perspective, because we do take a lot of inspiration from what countries there are doing currently and have been doing historically. So it's really great to have that perspective. And I want to thank the organizers and everyone who attended today, because it really did impact on me also that you aren't alone, as Alejandro was saying. And this is how I feel that connection globally, because, you know, sometimes we can get kind of boxed in feeling that our fights are the only fights and that we're the only people pushing those fights. So a big, big thanks for today.
Thank you. I'm also going to join in the thanks to everyone and especially to you. And I'm going to hand back to Gurula and Marike for ending the evening. Thank you all.
Here, I just wanted to share a very good example of learning from each other. You will see the elements of climate justice out of the Climate Justice Charter, which inspired us very much in the preparation for an educational material, like a mind map on the different issues where we should get active. And we tried to adopt these elements in the German discourses and invite people now with the mind map to find out about alternatives and the fields where we have to get active for climate justice. And I really would like to thank you again, Awande and your colleagues, that you shared it with us and inspired us very much. Yes, and I hope we continue to be in exchange and maybe have a workshop together or something like that, to have another or many more discussions about this and get active on the different levels. So this, we will send you some of this if you would like to have the posters in South Africa. And everyone else can have them in the epits if you're interested. I will just share where you could get it in the chat. Yes, and last, here is our contact. So you can see Gurula and me, but Bildungskraft Entwicklung in general, and a link for the Climate Justice Charter. But I think we already sent this out with the invitation for tonight. Yes. Your last word, sorry?
I just wanted to add that we now have a website for the Climate Justice Charter Movement, and I'll write that down in the chat.
Ah, thank you very much. So a direct link. Okay.
Well, then I take over. Thanks a lot to Awande and also Alejandro and Daniela for the facilitation and all you people who were listening and discussing and making so important thoughts. I think it was a really great evening, and let's hope or let's work together on it. Thank you.
I have a question, question about the evaluation of this night. Do I need an evaluation or how is this because you are also better, no? Here.
We are going to handle it. So
okay, cool.
You will receive everything you need.
Sorry. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Have a good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
I'm going to just leave a video here, maybe so that you can laugh a little bit. You can watch this video here in the chat. Chongesen, you saw it already. Okay, maybe you can laugh or you can cry. I don't know, but yeah.
Okay.
Well, people, thank you very much. I'm leaving now.
Thank you.
Bye. It was a privilege to be here. It was a pleasure to be here, and also to hear. It was really nice to hear your people from the Global South.
Hello, I'm from the government.
All right. See you. Bye.
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 Bye.